Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I'm Cindy House, here with Lizzie Ngo, and I have said that tagline 300 times.
Sound the trumpets, sound the trumpets, sound the trumpets. It's our 300th episode.
And of course, me being me, before we get into everything to celebrate 300, I just want to take care of the housekeeping, of course. So Basic Folk has a mailing list, once a month email list that helps you keep track of what's going on with the podcast. You can sign up for that at the link in the show notes or basicfolk.com. That is the best way to stay in touch with us. We're on social media at Basic Folk Pod, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and Blue Sky. And you can also become a contributing member to Basic Folk. It is free to listen, but it's not free to produce. So if you want to help out, help pay for your listening, you can give $5 a month, get a handmade Basic Folk beanie. You can do that at the link in the show notes or find it at basicfolk.com. Okay, I should have said this earlier, actually, but our guest today on our 300th episode is Sierra Hull.
Sierra!
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. But first, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. This podcast began in 2018 as a way to foster the folk community. I grew up in folk music in the New England scene, and I was in Pittsburgh, and I had been in Pittsburgh for like 10 plus years, and I felt really disconnected, and I wanted to be a part of it again and give musicians the kind of space and validation in order to tell their stories and talk about their artwork, because I find music to be a lifesaver over and over and over again. And I feel like there was so much that we could learn from our favorite folk musicians that we listen to every day. And I've learned so much from all of the guests that have been on Basic Folk. I've learned so much from you, Lizzie. I've learned from our listeners. It's just been a wonderful experience doing this podcast.
Cindy, I'm so proud of you. And I've learned so much from you, even since before I was a co-host on this podcast. Like, from the first time that we spoke when you were interviewing me back in 2019, I was like, this is someone who cares about music and understands kind of how artists think and the types of questions we like to be asked and the types of questions we are so bored of being asked and we're tired of it. And so to be asked to be part of this podcast 3 years ago was transformative for me as an artist, because it felt like I'm not just like throwing my art out there and hoping someone understands it. Like, I get to be part of the conversation of what's going on in folk music and what it means to be a folk musician. And the friendship that you and I have has like empowered, I think, both of us to ask the big questions and do a lot of exploring. So I'm so grateful for our 300th episode, because this show has changed my life.
Oh, yeah. Mine too. And this year, 2025, is a big year for Basic Folk. We officially became a production of The Bluegrass Situation.
We love you, Ed Helms.
You asked me earlier offline, like, what I would have told myself when I first started this. And I think what I would have told myself is that it's going to be really hard, but keep going one day, because the legitimization that I feel from like being a part of The Bluegrass Situation is like, it just like makes it all worth it.
It's huge. We are part of a very cool crew at The Bluegrass Situation. And at the time that this episode comes out, we are going to be at sea with our Bluegrass Situation colleagues doing interviews on the Kayamo cruise. And then shortly after that, should we do our big reveal?
Yeah, totally.
We are going to be in, drumroll please, Alaska.
Alaska.
We're going to Alaska.
Yes, we've been invited by Parlor in the Rounds, which is this sweet organization that puts on concerts in Alaskan communities. Basic Folk will be a part of it at the end of March. So heads up if you are in Anchorage or Juneau and you're looking for something to do in March, which you probably will be because...
because Alaska. We're going to be bundled up. We're going to be doing these live shows. We're going to be meeting local artists. I think sky's the limit for Basic Folk in 2025 and beyond.
So watch out for those Kayamo episodes. They'll be coming out, I think, in maybe like a couple months. Also very excited. These interviews are booked, but not yet recorded. I didn't tell you this yet, Lizzie, but...
oh my gosh.
I'm going to be talking to Bonnie Prince Billy, a.k.a. Will Oldham.
I'm sorry, guys. If you're listening only on audio, my jaw was just like on the desk.
Okay, the other big one is get ready for this. Loudon Wainwright III.
Stop that. You stop that. Okay, can I play my cover of the swimming song during the interview? And maybe you don't even tell him I'm part of the podcast. I just sort of lurk in with my guitar. How do you think that would go?
I think it would go really well.
One way or another, we will see y'all at sea if you're going to be at the Kayamo Cruise. The episodes that we did last year at sea were truly legendary. So I'm excited to see what conversations we have this year.
All right, let's get into Sierra Hull on Basic Folk 300. Okay, when mandolinist Sierra Hull was little, her dad told her that she was really good for a 10-year-old. The older Hull knew Sierra had a fiery passion for the instrument, and he knew exactly how to motivate his daughter. He went on to say that if she wanted to go to jams and porch play for the rest of her life, she'd learned enough. He gave her the realistic advice that if she wanted to dedicate her life to music, she would have to work really hard because that 10-year-old cute thing is gonna wear off. Sierra, who drew pictures of herself playing at the Grand Ole Opry with Alison Krauss and album covers with the Rounder Records logo, took his advice to heart and got to work. Since then, she's shared the stage with more heroes than we can count, inspired a new generation of younger players, released 5 albums, and is considered a master of the mandolin. Originally from the small town of Byrdstown, Tennessee, she's just released, or is about to release, depending on when you listen to this episode, her new album, A Tiptoe High Wire. Sierra reflects on how growing up in a small town shaped her musical identity alongside bluegrass, gospel, and family traditions. She shares memories of family gatherings filled with music featuring Aunt Betty and Uncle Junior, the profound influence of church hymns, and how these experiences continue to resonate in her playing and songwriting. Sierra discusses the significance of her latest album, her first independent release, highlighting the freedom and growth that come with that independence. She emphasizes the importance of authenticity in her music, allowing herself to explore new sounds while remaining grounded in her bluegrass roots. Sierra opens up about her personal growth, the pressures of being labeled a child prodigy, and her journey toward embracing imperfection in her art. Aren't we all? We also dive into what we'll call her Stevie Nicks era with the amazing cover art on her new record. Sierra enjoys playing with elaborate styles in her album artwork and red carpet looks. Hello, CMAs. With a candid perspective on the challenges of the music industry, Sierra encourages listeners to find joy in the process and appreciate the beauty of vulnerability. Wonderful conversation. So excited for you all to hear this. Let's listen to a clip from her new record. This is Boom, and then we'll get to our conversation with Sierra Hull on Basic Folk's 300th episode.
Light in your heart, flip the switch, left you lonely, sitting in the dark.
Some
Sierra Hull, this is so exciting. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
We're going to talk about your whole life and your new record. So let's get into it.
Sounds good.
You're originally from Byrdstown, Tennessee. It's right by the Kentucky border. It's a really small town. I looked up the population as of 2020. There are 798 people living there. How do you think being from a town this size continues to impact you and impact the musician you've become?
Well, I think growing up, you know, in this part of the world, especially like being from Tennessee, there's so much music, you know, in that kind of bluegrass country gospel style. And growing up in a small town where I didn't like my family's not directly from Byrdstown. Most of my my mom and dad grew up in the next town over, which is Jamestown, Tennessee, but like 30 minutes down the road, very close.
Right.
And as far back as almost any of us know, my grandparents, their grandparents, like everybody's kind of been in that part of the world. So many, many generations of folks on both sides of my family being from, you know, that part of the world. So growing up, it's like there wasn't a lot going on in a small town. Everybody just kind of turns to music as a form of sort of entertainment, not to be on a stage, but, you know, music and church was a big part of it. I think my great grandpa, who I never got to meet, but so I've been told was the organ or the piano player in the same church that my grandparents, who were in their 90s, still go to. And his twin sister played organ. So, you know, music just kind of always being around, even in the old hymns kind of way, long before anybody really was a fan of bluegrass. But my parents built a house whenever I was, well, probably right before I was born. My brother was already born at the time. But right before I came into the world, they built a little house in Byrdstown next to my mom's aunt. So my great aunt and uncle.
Betty and Junior.
Betty and Junior, you got it. Yeah. So Junior played a little bit. And so I think just like growing up around that kind of environment where everybody from my granny to my great aunt, like people just grew up singing. So music was kind of, you know, it was a way to pass the time. And I think that has carried down from just generations of people being from a small town like that, where that's kind of part of what you do to pass the time. And I was lucky to have some of that handed down, I think.
Oh, I love that. So you were talking about music in church. How do you relate to church music now? Like, where do you hear it in your playing and in your writing?
Well, I think for me, like, I grew up hearing songs out of like the red hymnal book, you know, those old songs. And there's just a certain kind of beauty, poetic writing style to a lot of those old songs that, you know, I look back now kind of without even realizing. You know, for a long time, you don't think about it. You know, there's songs that are kind of just ingrained in you because you hear them every week in church or you've just heard that kind of music your whole life. But, certainly I think that the simplicity of the power of simplicity in music sometimes, when I go back and I hear those songs, I'm always moved by that. You know, I think, especially as somebody that, as I've gotten more interested in all kinds of music and, you know, find myself getting into some pretty progressive areas instrumentally and things like that, there's something always really grounding and that feeling of home coming back to just a beautiful, simple, powerful lyric, you know, to say a lot with a little. And I think that's kind of partly why bluegrass always feels so at home to me too. And I'm sure the connection to that probably had a lot to do with the connection of the early music that I was hearing, you know, like those old hymns and stuff.
I was looking at a map of Byrdstown and it seems like there's like a really big body of water right by the town, Dale Hollow Lake.
Yeah, Dale Hollow Lake.
How much interaction did you have with the lake? Like, what does it mean to you?
Well, my dad, like, he's always loved to fish and, you know, my parents, like, they didn't have much money when I was growing up. So, you know, they worked all the time and, you know, to have something like that we could just go down to the lake and go swimming on a weekend, maybe for free, you know, it's like, that's a pretty wonderful activity to have or for just a couple bucks. My dad even, actually, when I was growing up, he first worked at a sawmill there in Byrdstown. And then shortly after, or maybe this was even right before, I forget, but for a little bit, he worked at the Sunset Marina dock there on Dale Hollow Lake, like, you know, helping build some of the dock itself and different things like that. So, you know, I think having having something like that in your town too, when you don't have a lot of other things that people kind of think of, like most of the time, even now, I've lived in Nashville for many years, or, you know, met all kinds of people in and around Tennessee, and you say Byrdstown, and half the time people don't even know where it's at, even if they're from here, you know, because it's just such a small town. But if people love to fish, like the world record smallmouth bass, or it used to be at least, I think maybe still is the record, was caught out of the lake there. And it's a very just like beautiful, it's a beautiful, clean lake that people like to come and, you know, spend their 4th of Julys and go out on houseboats and things like that. So, you know, I think it's definitely like feels like a symbol of home, just because it's sort of one of the things that maybe if you mention Del Hollow Lake, somebody knows where Byrdstown is.
Oh, right on. Okay. You were talking about how everybody in your family was playing music, and it seems like the party house was at your aunt and uncle's, Betty and Junior's, if I'm like understanding correctly. You know, what were those parties like? And like, what were the kids doing while those parties were going on?
Well, I really wasn't a party per se. It's funny because, you know, it's like I think of spending most every day of my life being in their house at some point or another. I mean, I never had a babysitter or anything like that beyond them. We were just lucky. They were like a second set of grandparents. And my Uncle Junior, probably by the time I was, you know, getting about old enough to even start playing, he had retired from the sawmill himself where he worked. And my Aunt Betty was a stay-at-home woman her whole life. And so, you know, it was like every day in the summer, we were lucky that we could stay there. So I remember walking in their house, and I don't even know if I remember any kind of like specific parties or anything like that that they would host, but pretty much any day of the week you could walk in, and my Uncle Junior, especially when he was retired, would be playing the fiddle or the mandolin. He had a guitar up there, and he was a preacher, and that was kind of part of why I think my mom and dad became very involved in church and us going to church every week and stuff like that. And just that kind of being part of the sounds that we would hear in church, you know. It's like occasionally somebody would pull out a guitar and play it, you know, living in a town that's 700 people. As you know, it's kind of funny, even in a small town, there's a million churches. You can throw a rock and there's another one every little bit, but that means you might have 20 people, might be a full house.
Right.
You know what I mean? On a Sunday morning. So it was a very casual way to kind of like have music feel welcoming, because there wasn't necessarily, at least the way I grew up with it, it wasn't like a program where you have to get scheduled in. It'd be like, hey, you kids got a song you want to sing today? And, you know, we would get invited to sing. And so I remember, you know, my dad learning to play guitar just enough by borrowing one of my uncle's guitars, and learning to play just enough that he could sort of play some chords while my brother and I would sing. And it was only kind of a little bit after that dad started getting into bluegrass. But Junior and Betty, they never really were, like I said, nobody was trying to be on a stage. They sang a little bit in church and way to kind of pass the time with my granny. And Betty and my granny's brother Bobby, his family played a little bit as well. But, you know, it was very casual in that way, never in a bluegrass context per se, until my dad started getting into bluegrass a little bit.
Oh, that's cool. Your brother Cody started playing banjo. You were 8 years old. And like most little sisters, I am also a little sister, so this definitely tracks. You wanted to do what Cody did, which led you to eventually getting a mandolin. He would go on to play in your band, Sierra Hull Highway 111. What kind of rapport did you and Cody have as kids, and how did that translate into your musical relationship?
Oh, gosh. I mean, to this day, he's still one of my best friends in the world. Like, I think just it being the two of us, you know, and we're only about 2.5 years apart. So, you know, there's a real bond and closeness there. And yeah, I totally wanted to do the banjo with him. Didn't really stick, but my dad brought home a banjo and he had a guitar. And so he was trying to get my brother excited about playing something. So, you know, he plays mostly guitar these days, but when we were growing up, he played some electric bass too, and kind of toggled between the bass and the guitar. And then whatever my brother wasn't playing in that moment, my dad would sort of try to fill the role, whether it was playing guitar or bass in the moment. But yeah, I mean, we grew up singing together. That's how I learned to sing harmony, was singing with him. And, you know, we still love playing some music when we get together on the holidays and whatever, if he comes down to visit or I go up there. So, yeah, really a special thing just to have that with your sibling. I think that sibling harmony, there's kind of nothing like that, you know, the sound of family harmony and being able to learn and grow. Now, he's super talented in a lot of other areas. You know, for me, music, like the moment I started playing, it was like all in, you know, 1,000%. This is what I want to do. It was like, I mean, it's funny thinking back. I don't remember a time where I didn't know that's what I wanted to do with my life. It's not like I did it for a while and kind of thought, well, I'll do something else and suddenly had an epiphany. It almost feels like it had to have been real soon because it didn't take me any time to be deciding, gosh, this is what I want to make albums. I want to tour. I want to do what my heroes are doing. Now, Cody, he had a lot of other interests. You know, he loved sports. He played a lot of sports. And I always loved, like, you know, with him shooting basketball at, you know, whatever, in the evenings after school or throwing the baseball. I was always a real tomboy in that way and loved those kind of things. But
you weren't about to be a D1 athlete.
No, music was just it for me, you know. And so he had, I don't know, he just had a lot of other interests. And I think music was always part of that. But I don't think he ever quite wanted it to be his life's calling in the same way that I felt that was mine. You know?
Yeah, once you got your hands on the mandolin when you were 8 years old, you would play all the time. How does the way you first felt about the mandolin compare to how you feel about it now?
It's funny. It feels pretty similar. I mean, because I think that's the honest thing about, that's the awesome thing about music is that there's always something new to learn. Now, obviously, when you're learning a new hobby and it's just like you're really in the early stages of developing technique, you know, and different things like that, you're learning so much at this really noticeable rapid speed. You know, it's kind of like everything just feels like this crazy rapid succession of, like, you go from barely knowing the names of the strings to, like, suddenly if you put two fingers here, you can make a G chord. And then suddenly you realize, oh, well, if I do this, I can make a C chord and all these different things. And then you start to learn one tune turns into 10 tunes. And, you know, you can actually count the number of tunes, you know. And it's like, at this point in my life, I have no idea how much stuff I've learned because that's just been all I've ever done. But so it's a little harder to, like, measure progress, I think, now sometimes, where, you know, you can feel sort of like, where do I go from here? How do I keep things fresh and excited in that same kind of eager to pick up the instrument kind of way? But I still feel like that's the cool thing about music, is there's still so many things that get me excited to want to play the instrument and pick it up. You know, it's different because it was so centered around bluegrass at that point in time, you know, and now it's centered around kind of just whatever music I get excited by in a particular moment, with bluegrass still being the basis of that, but then also, you know, writing and singing, and there's kind of like a lot of other parts that go into it. But early on, yeah, mandolin was kind of like the, you know, and learning those bluegrass tunes and going to the bluegrass jams was really the thing that was like lighting my fire in a really special way.
Oh, really cool. You've played with many older musicians when you were young, and now you have many, like, bluegrass famous friendships with other musicians who are around your own age. How did you relate to, like, other kids growing up in terms of, like, playing music together, and what did you like about playing with other kids?
Yeah, well, it's so funny because my friend Vicky Vaughn just sent me a photo, like, just before we got on this interview, and it's a photo of me with another young musician. I mean, I was probably 10 years old, maybe 9 years old even. It looked like one of my very first IBMAs. And I was like, wow, that's such a blast from the past, you know? And I remember, like, that going to IBMA, I was lucky to get invited to come play there for their Kids on Bluegrass program, like, pretty soon after I started playing. I'd maybe been playing about a year the first time we went. You know, growing up in a small town, there's a lot of beautiful things about it, but you're in a remote area where you don't have heroes or people that, you don't have like big festivals going on nearby, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not that far from Nashville, only a couple hours away, but man, that might as well have been 10 hours when I was growing up. I mean, it's an hour off the interstate. There's a really, like, I don't know, you're kind of in your own little bubble a little bit.
Isn't that crazy? Like when you're growing up and you're like, man, it takes 7 hours to get to my grandmother's house. And then you grow up and I'm like, oh, that's only like 45 minutes from my house. Like the distance when you're a kid is crazy.
Totally. Well, and my parents worked, you know, long days, 5 days a week. The weekends were precious time that, you know, and sometimes it took my dad's and mom's last $5 to drive me to the bluegrass jam down the road, you know. So it's like the idea of like buying some expensive concert ticket in Nashville or even dealing with interstate driving, which is so hilarious to say, but it's like that's the kind of stuff I'm sure that would have made them nervous to even do, you know, let alone having to have an overnight trip somewhere or something. So it was like to be invited to somewhere like this IBMA thing, which at the time was in Louisville, Kentucky, that was like a huge trip, you know. And I remember,
how far is that from you?
That's a good question. I'd say it's probably at least three, four hours from where mm-hmm. I grew up. I may even mm-hmm. be wrong. I remember it feeling really far, you know, at the time. But like, I just remember, you know, as soon as my parents got off work on that Friday, us driving way up into the evening, getting there Friday night and being able to have all day Saturday and most all day Sunday, like felt like the biggest adventure. It's funny because now I go, we couldn't have been there more than like a day and a half, but it just felt like this insane experience because I did get to meet some kids for kind of the first time. Like I didn't go to school with people really that were playing acoustic instruments that really, you know, my brother and I played together, but there wasn't a whole lot of other kids. It was mostly me and, you know, older folks at the local jam. I went to a thing called the Smithville Fiddlers Jamboree, which is a festival in Smithville, Tennessee, and they do like a kids contest, and, you know, met a couple kids there, you know, friendships that I still have, but there wasn't anybody like regularly that I was mm-hmm. getting to hang out with. So
it was like a treat.
Yeah, to be invited to something that was literally kids on bluegrass, and there's, you know, like a whole room full of young people, and we're getting to jam together. It was so cool. It was like, wow, you know, this is a pretty unbelievable thing. I mean, that's how I met Sarah Jarosz for the first time. That's how I met Molly Tuttle. You know, the whole slew of other people that I still call friends to this day that we met as part of that, you know, which is pretty cool to look back on all these years later.
Yeah, being in Burrstown and kind of isolated, being so engrossed in the mandolin via gospel music and bluegrass music, how did like popular or mainstream culture impact you growing up? Like, were you into it? If so, like, did the mandolin help you access it at all? Like, were you playing Britney Spears Toxic at the bluegrass jam?
No, not really. I mean, it's funny, the first CD we ever got, it was like a big deal. I remember it was like a Christmas present. We got this boombox that was kind of a shared gift. It was a big gift for me and my brother to share. And the first CD was a Britney Spears CD, you know, and it was like new at the time. I think it was the Oops, I Did It Again or whatever.
Right. That's a big one. The first CD is a big one.
It was a big one. And I just remember being like, wow, this is so crazy. Because, you know, we had tapes before then. I was young. I was probably 8 or 9 or something like that. But, you know, my brother probably was more into some of that stuff than me. I was such a bluegrass nerd. You know, once I got down the bluegrass rabbit hole, I was all in. I mean, I couldn't have said that I like knew all the songs on the radio growing up. But my dad loved all kinds of music. You know, he grew up in the 80s loving, you know, all kinds of, like, pretty much if you turn on any kind of, you know, 80s rock on the radio station, he could basically sing every word, you know. Mom loved Journey and things like that, you know. So like, definitely it wasn't that I was like being like any of that was intentionally being withheld from me. I think I was just so into the mandolin and trying to learn those things. And we don't have a radio station in Burrstown, but, you know, if you tune in to even the local station in Jamestown, where I was talking about my parents are from, and that's just an itty bitty station. The bigger station mm-hmm. would be like an hour away in Cookeville, Tennessee. You know, the most of the music you would hear would be like mainstream country at the time. So I grew up knowing a lot of country songs almost by default. It's funny, if I'm sitting in a restaurant now and some of these songs come on, it's like I know every word and I almost surprise myself. Like, how do I know all these songs?
Right,
because
right.
If you've turned the radio dial on to sort of the main stations around where I grew up, it was mostly country. And then I loved CMT at the time, too, and kind of would watch CMT hoping to see a Nickel Creek video pop up or an Alison Krauss video. You know, you might occasionally, I remember Del McCurry had a video on around the time, or like the Green Cards. There was a few bands that had mandolins in them, and I would always be like, oh, wow, that's cool. Or even the Dixie Chicks had a version of that song Landslide, you know, the Fleetwood Mac song. And I remember there was a mandolin solo in it. And I always thought it was so cool anytime you saw the mandolin pop up on a CMT video.
Yeah.
So I kind of kept up with that a little bit, you know, by default. But
oh, cool. More on Fleetwood Mac and your Stevie Nicks era in a bit here during our conversation.
Yes.
So this is a little bit of a setup for this question. You put your first record out when you were 10. And you were kind of alluding to this quote of yours, like when you were young, you were called a child prodigy, which is something that you like to downplay. So let me just read this quote of yours. You can learn a lot in 2 years when you're really focused. 2 years in the life of a child is like 20 years. At least it feels like that. There's a rate of growth that happens so quickly. That's what you were alluding to earlier. So I've thought a lot about how in music and in entertainment, the novelty of youth wears off. And as you get older, you kind of need to figure out what makes you singular. So what have your concerns been about being cuckolded as like the young mandolin player as you've settled into your 30s?
Yeah, it's funny. I think when you grow up with that a little bit, and I was so fortunate to have all these amazing opportunities at a really young age. I mean, looking back now and thinking about some of the things I got to do, you know, early on, it's like, well, then you become in your 30s and you're like, well, you can't have your debut on this stage again. Like, you know, you kind of already done that thing. And how do you now want, you know, you figure out ways to do it in your own way or be able to do it, you know, as your own artist singing your own songs. You know, it's one thing to get to play Red Rocks or play Carnegie Hall or whatever, like the Grand Ole Opry, some of these things, you know, but then, you know, to actually kind of be growing into an adult musician all of a sudden, you know, moving from that youth stage into adulthood, it is a little bit tricky sometimes. I don't, like, for me, it's not something that I've sat around and thought about a lot. I think there was always a part of me that knew. My dad was always a realist in so many ways. So I remember him telling me when I was maybe 10 years old, like I said, I always knew this is what I wanted. I used to draw pictures of myself, you know, on stage with Alison Krauss in Union Station. Like, she was my biggest hero at the time, you know. And I used to make these faux album covers and put the Rounder Records logo on the back because, like, she recorded for that label. Toni Rice recorded for that label. Like, so many of my heroes were on that label. So I was always dreaming about it, like, before I was knew any of these people, you know, which is funny to say because it was probably only within a year of playing. And I look back now and I was like, how did I know that much that this is totally that I was that sold on this that soon? But somehow I was.
You probably didn't watch any TV growing up.
I did some, though. That's what's so crazy. And just, I guess, the life of a child, you just feel like it's not like I was deprived of anything. It's just, just something that, you know, I guess those few hours in the evening that you spend caring about music go a long way when you're, yeah, you know, don't have all the other things flooding your mind. But yeah, I think, like, you know, my dad, I was probably about 10 years old and I had gone on and on about how, oh, it was my dream to get to play the Grand Ole Opry. But for some reason, like specifically with Alison Krauss, that was just like, I wanted to play with her, but I wanted to play with her at the Grand Ole Opry. And I'd like drawn these pictures when I was like 9 years old or so of wanting that to happen. And I remember my dad realized a period of time where I was getting a little lazy. And I'll say, like, my parents didn't push me in a way, like, you know, any more than they really did my brother. But I think that especially my dad saw that this is something that I really said I wanted. And so I do feel like there was a reminder or a subtle push, you know, that would come from like, hey, well, you know, I'm here to help you with all this. Like, I'll take time out of my day. I'll spend my last few dollars to take you to this jam if you're going to be serious about it. But if you're not, I could be spending my time doing something that I kind of want to be doing. And, you know, it's like it was that time and money and resources and all that stuff were kind of precious. And I think I was made aware of that at a very young age to where there was a little bit of like awareness even early on. Like I got it. I was like, oh, I have to like if I'm going to be taken to all these places, like I can't just like run off and, you know, throw the football with, you know, my brother and his friends, because really I know the main reasons here is because I'm the one that wanted to come so bad. So I have to make sure that I'm like getting my time in while I'm here, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I was being kind of a little bit lazy and not really practicing too much at one point. And I remember my dad saying, Sierra, you've been a little lazy lately. You ain't really been working on your playing too much. What's up with that? And I was like, oh, I don't know. And he goes, well, you know what's going to happen. One of these days, Allison Krauss is going to call you to come play with her, but you're just not going to be ready. And so there was always this kind of like weird belief that he had in me that this could happen, or he was good at, you know, faking it to try to motivate me, I guess. But I guess I went, oh gosh, yeah, like that would be bad. Like, what if she calls me and then I can't actually play these songs, or I don't know. So I would kind of jumpstart me to get back in the chair and practice and kind of do the things that I already at the heart of it knew I wanted to do. But it's easy to be distracted as an adult from the things we want to do sometimes, let alone as a child, you know. And just last thing I'll say on that is I remember him saying, you know, right now you're really good at playing the mandolin. You know, you're 10 years old or whatever it was. He said, you've been playing a couple years. Like, you can go to any of the jams and you know most of the songs, and even the ones you don't know, you can kind of play your way through a little bit. I was learning to improvise a little enough that I could sort of take solos and stuff. And he said, and you know, right now though, he said, everybody goes, wow, look at that little girl. Like, she's amazing. She's, you know, look at how good she is. I can't believe she can play that way at 10 years old. And he goes, and you are. He goes, you're really good for a 10-year-old. You've worked hard to get here. And he goes, and if all you want to do is go to jams on the weekend and sit on the front porch till you're an old lady and play the mandolin and find joy in it, then you probably don't have to learn another thing. You already probably know enough that you're good for a hobby to just be good at this and have fun. He said, but if you want it like you say you do, you got a long way to go, because at some point that 10-year-old cute thing is going to wear off. And he said, and then, you know, if you're 16 and you still sound like you did when you'd only been playing 2 years at 10 years old, you know, nobody's really going to care. Nobody's going to talk about that. Nobody's going to invite you to come do things. Like, if you really want this, you've got to work at it, and you've got to continue to be the best you can be at it. And when you're 16, you need to sound like you've been playing since you were 8. When you're 25, you need to sound like you've dedicated your life to this. So it's good advice, and very real, realistic advice for a youngster to hear.
I'd like to extend an invitation to Sierra Hull's dad to come on the podcast and share more parenting tips, because I'm blown away. That's amazing.
Yeah, my dad's a bit of a no-nonsense person sometimes, you know? It's like, you know, I never doubted that he or my mom were proud of me, but they sure were never trying to be stage parents or like, push me to be a star. That was never it. I think it was kind of like, hey kid, we've worked jobs we don't like our whole lives, and we've not made a lot of money even doing that. You know what I mean? So like, if you can go do something you love and actually be successful at it, then work hard, go get it. Like, it's here for the taking, but you're gonna have to want it and work for it, you know?
Let's talk about your main competition, Chris Thiele.
There's no contest there. There's no contest there.
So you met Chris at Merle Fest around 2000, 2001. He is 10 years older than you. So at this point, when you met, he was in his early 20s. And this is like a very heartwarming scene when you first meet like an older player. A boy, in fact, is treating you like a peer, legitimizing you. How did those types of situations impact your confidence as a player? Like, even though you're 10 years old, you're validated by many people who normally would not pay attention to a kid in a mandolin.
Yeah, well, I think like meeting Chris, I mean, he was such a big hero. He'll forever be, you know, one of my biggest influences and heroes. And so to have had the opportunity to actually meet him at such a young age and have that kind of warmth and kindness extended to me, I know that's a big part in why I stuck with all this. I know it is. Like going to these, you know, I often say I loved the music, but I don't know if I would have wanted to dedicate as much time and energy to it if I didn't love the people that I was getting to meet and interact with and the way those people made me feel accepted and welcomed and encouraged and all that. And many of those were, you know, males. I honestly didn't get to interact with a lot of female musicians growing up. It was all a lot of older male musicians, but they didn't treat me any different because they were a lot older than me too, in most cases. You know, a lot of times I'd be the only kid, but yet somehow, you know, they found a seat for me at the table, even when I didn't know very much, and said, oh, and I think it's because they sensed how much I loved it and that I wanted to be a part of it. And I think when somebody can, you know your intention and know that you're really, you know, interested in the thing that they love, like I'm like that, regardless of age or gender or, you know, race, like anything. If somebody loves something that you love, how can you not get excited about wanting to share the thing you're passionate about with somebody who, you know, wants to know about that same thing? So I think being able to, you know, meet somebody like Chris, of course, I was, you know, trying my darndest to learn some of those songs and solos of his, you know, he was such a hero to me. I think, you know, it was very kind of him to take time the way he did when we first met. And, you know, I can say the same thing about Sam Bush or Adam Steffi or Ricky Skaggs or, you know, Allison, you know, a lot of the folks that I met along the way. I've been really, really fortunate that my heroes have been such awesome people as well.
Another famous part of your story is that Rounder Records signed you when you were 13. I did not know that fact about you drawing their logo on the back of album covers. That's so cute. So when they signed you, you were 13, and they're like, we're going to let you develop at your own pace, which I wonder, like, how has that impacted the cadence of your album releases? It seems like they have been calculated. Like, you're in your early 30s. You've been making records since you were 10 years old, and you are only on your 6th record.
slow process. It's funny because, like, you know, sometimes somebody, I remember I said something about, like, yeah, I feel like I'm just very slow, and somebody's like, I don't feel like you're slow, you've put out how many records? And I was like, yeah, but I've been doing it since I was a kid, so yeah, it's kind of slow. I think I'm grateful that, like, Rounder gave me the opportunity to move at my own speed. You know, I think, like, I've always been a bit of a perfectionist, and I've always wanted to do things that, yeah, it's it's a tricky existence sometimes, because you always feel like, well, you're never quite good enough or never quite there, or this needs to be better, or, you know, maybe this, maybe that, you know, a lot of self-doubt and things like that, that one can struggle with in those ways. And so also, like, you know, you grow up with somebody, like, I've thought about this and I've talked to her a lot about it, even recently. I was like, you know, you grew up with somebody like Alison Krauss as sort of your hero. Those records are so pristine and perfect, and, you know, they feel that way. I know they don't to her, but, you know, to us as the listeners, or somebody like Toni Rice, those albums just feel so untouchable, and you dream of making music that can exist anywhere in the realm of, like, those kind of records, where be it sonically or emotionally or all those things. So I don't know. I think part of it is just, like, you know, taking my time and definitely always trying to value quality over quantity, you know, which is tricky in the world we live in today, where it's like everything's all about the algorithms and feeding the machine and, you know, got to put something out every 5 seconds or people lose attention. Their attention spans go elsewhere and things like that. You know, it's a little bit sometimes counterintuitive to just the way I've done things. And even though sometimes I think, why am I waiting this long between records? I just have kind of had to have come to some level of acceptance of, well, this is just how I guess I pace things, because I have to really feel ready to put it out or I'm just not gonna. So
on writing, you've been writing songs since your 2011 album Daybreak. What did you like about writing your own music, and how do you relate to that feeling about writing now?
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, I had started writing even before that. Like, I had written instrumental tunes. I had written a couple songs with my dad. I had written some songs with my brother here and there. And it's like, I remember even writing the song Daybreak, and at the time feeling like, well, this isn't really a bluegrass song. This doesn't really, like, sound like something I would play with this particular band that was doing shows with me at the time. And so it was like, I had these songs that I was like, well, I really like this, but I'm probably never going to record this because I just don't see the space for it, which is such a funny, funny thing to think about. And it was really a bit around the process of making that record and then moving into the next record that it became more of like, why am I feeling like I can't just record or sing the things that I want to sing? Like, who cares where it fits in? Like, it's all going to sound kind of bluegrass influence, because how can it not? I mean, I play the mandolin, and this is part of my core, you know, of what I come from. So I think at some point around that time, just letting go of that and kind of, I mean, I remember looking at my set list one time and thinking about the lyrics and being like, there's just not enough of me here. There's not enough of, like, what I want to say and what I want to feel in these words. So why am I depriving myself of that when I can write songs and I can, you know, kind of put that part of myself into the music and have that extra layer of connection personally, you know? And of course, you hope other people like it too. But, like, I do think it's important that you feel that with whatever, whether you write the songs or you don't. Like, plenty of people don't write their own songs, and they're great interpreters and know how to take someone else's words and paint their own story and picture with it. But yeah, it was around that time that I was just kind of gave myself permission, I guess, to do that, regardless of whether it turned out to be a bluegrass song or not.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations on being independent. The new album, A Tiptoe High Wire. There's a lot of firsts on this album. Your first self-produce, the first featuring your band, and your first independent release. You have said that the freedom has allowed you to grow. What has that growth looked like in this newfound freedom? Have there been any surprises you've discovered along the way?
Well, so I will say, you know, I did produce this record, but I've got to give some co-producer credit to my friend Shawnee Gandhi, who's the engineer on the record as well. And this record wouldn't be what it is without her. We did my 25 Trips album together. And this record, the process of it was a little bit different, because I was sort of coming into this record choosing the songs myself and mostly having the songs arranged with using the band members and stuff like that in a different way, rather than my previous record. We started the whole thing from the ground up, and it was kind of like, who do we want on this? Which songs are we going to choose? Like, all these kind of, you know, it was a very different process. But, you know, having that rapport with her before and having her ears and sonic, you know, just mastery that she kind of brings to things, you know, gotta give her the shout out. And same thing with being able to use the band guys. I mean, there's nothing like being able to have people that you've played a lot of music with. And then you bring a new song to that group of people, and you already have this built-in chemistry that things kind of come together in a different way than they do if you're just putting five musicians in a room together who have never played before, which is primarily what I've done on my records. And that's really exciting too. But there's something super special about kind of having, you know, the same voices that reoccur throughout a record, and the same, you know, musical interpretations of songs that you've been performing live, like to be able to put that on a recording. So a lot of these songs were born out of going out and playing them live first, which I've never really done that before. Not all of them, but a good bunch of them, like Boom, the song that's out now. You know, we started kind of workshopping that one with the touring band before. And I don't know, there's like, I feel a real connection about playing these songs live now in a different way that maybe I haven't ever felt with a record before as a result. It's like maybe the first time being able to take the same sounds that we had in the studio to the live stage rather than being like, oh, well, so-and-so played guitar on this part and somebody else is kind of just learning their parts, you know? It's like, no, these are parts that you played on the record, you know? So you get to share that on the live stage. And the being independent part is a little scary, but it feels really, you know, empowering in a lot of ways to have, you know, this be this far in my career to kind of step into this kind of role. Certainly feels different, you know, but it felt like the right moment to do that and, you know, kind of have ownership of my music in a way that I've not had previously. Mm.
Now we've reached the Stevie Nicks portion of the interview. You have, since your 2016 album, Weighted Mind, you've used your own image like really creatively. It seems like creatively, thematically, and intentionally. So first of all, I want to hear about this Stevie Nicks Lord of the Rings persona that we see on a tiptoe high wire. You are in this amazing green velvet cape with lace sleeves. So how did we get here, Sierra?
Well, we got here in part because we hired a really great stylist. We got a lot of really fun clothes to the shoot, and we did like probably 5 or 6 different looks, but for some reason I just loved this green cape, and I felt like this particular color tone, it was not something that you know, I had worn a lot, but there was something really earthy about it. And I feel like this is a very earthy kind of record in that, you know, part of the title, A Tiptoe High Wire, comes from one of the songs on the album called Spitfire. But like the idea of a tiptoe high wire, you know, to me, there's just such an image that painted in my mind, like in the way of stepping into this new independent space for the first time and it being empowering, but also kind of scary and taking the roots and the things of the music that I've loved that I want to hold on to, the pieces of me that just love a good, simple song, like what we talked about at the beginning of the interview, that love those simple melodies, but also, on the other hand, has had this amazing opportunity over the last several years to collaborate with tons of people and learn a lot from a lot of different genres and bring all those sounds and inspirations back to my own music. So wanting to kind of lean into the progressiveness of that and the things, the explorative nature, if you will, of music. So like kind of stepping into this space and kind of juggling those things, you know. So I don't know, something about that green cape just felt like kind of empowering in its own way, in this like earthy way that I guess the other things I tried on didn't feel. And so we all like, I put it on and we were all kind of like, I think this is the cover look.
Oh, wow.
And you never know. You never know when you're doing a shoot, but that was kind of our hope that we would get something from that had the cover shot.
It's so awesome. You look amazing.
Thank you.
I just wish the stylist had brought along their cockatoo for you to hold to really complete the belladonna look. Did they let you keep that green cape?
I didn't get to keep it, no, but... Ugh. But it was pretty great. It was fun, yeah. Fun to get to wear for the moment.
Right. Forever living on this album cover. It's really great.
Thank you.
So we were talking about this a little bit, about like exploring new progressive territory without wandering too far from your gospel bluegrass roots. So like for you, like where is the line when it comes to pushing the tradition forward, and how has that line evolved on the new album?
I almost don't even think of it as a line. I almost, to be quite honest, try to think of it not at all. I think because to me, thinking about it gets in the way of trying to just make something honest and meaningful. And I think if you can just not think about it, which is sort of like erasing the line a little bit, then there's room for whatever comes on a given day. If, you know, and that's the funny thing about being creative or sitting down to write songs or whatever you're feeling in a given moment. Sometimes that comes out in the form of something really recognizable. That's like a very familiar, nostalgic sound that might just be something really simple. And some days you're just feeling, you know, maybe you've had that extra cup of coffee and you're just feeling froggy and you're like searching for something new and exciting or something that feels good under the fingers to play or a melody that just feels like not a melody I've sang very much before, or whatever it might be, you know, words that maybe sometimes you don't even know what they mean until you're writing them. But to, I don't know, to just have the openness to lean into that, I think, you know, is what I try to do, you know, which means not thinking about those lines very much.
So with the song Boom, people referred you to the opening line of Coconut by Harry Nilsson.
Somebody said that on my social media. Is it a similar, like, I don't even know what the opening line to, of course I know the lime and the coconut, right? So
yeah.
I mean, they put the lime and the coconut. So I wasn't sure if it was like the beat that kind of reminded them of it or it's the opening lyric.
It's the melody.
Oh, I think it's the melody. That's what I figured they were referring to.
Yeah. There's a great version of that song that the Muppets did that I highly recommend if you need to listen to that song again. The original is also quite good, but the Muppets one is
the Muppets
excellent.
Take the cake.
they certainly do. Okay, so the message of the song Boom is getting by or getting over missteps and transgressions, which, damn, that's a lesson I think we are all learning over and over and over again. Like, you make mistakes, you are, like, not a bad devil person.
Yeah, and sometimes it's kind of like, just look, it's not, the world's not ending. It doesn't have to be that way. Like, you know, sometimes we all just need to get over it. Come on, you know?
You need a slap in the face, or like maybe you need a sandwich.
The sun is shining, you know, metaphorically speaking, even when we think it isn't, you know.
Historically, what has it been like for you in like getting over mistakes, and how conscious are you, as you are in this song, how conscious are you in trying to cheer yourself up?
You know, I'm getting better as I get older, I think, at like just kind of being, you know, I think for me, it's, you can be so precious about everything. And even talking about the perfectionistic kind of tendencies and things like that, that can in some ways be the thing that holds you back too, you know, because you're not allowing yourself to share with the world, so be it, the thing that I want to do. It's like, I can make music for myself all day long and have a good time, kind of like my dad said when I was, you know, a kid, if I'm just doing it for me. But I've never wanted to do it just for me. You know, I've always wanted to be able to do it because I love the connection that you get by sharing music with people, whether it's playing music with people, whether it's singing a lyric to someone that maybe they can take something and feel something from it. The way music makes me feel that I love when I hear it, and knowing what that does for me in my life, it's like you can only imagine of giving that to somebody in some way, you know, and what a special thing. So like, I've always, I don't know, you get so protective of the thing because you love it so much and you care so much about it, you know, and it's like you have a bad show, you beat yourself up about it because you weren't everything you wanted to be, you know, maybe you practiced something right 1,000 times, you know, sitting here in the little office room, and then, you know, you get on stage and you're like, dang it, like I screwed it up, or I forgot the lyrics, or like whatever it might be, but we're human, you know what I mean? So I think like as I'm getting older, I'm trying to just like see the beauty in the perfection or the imperfections, you know, and not dwell so much on thinking things need to be perfect. I mean, that's kind of boring anyway, right? Like perfection can be boring, and what even is perfection? Because everybody's got their own idea of what that looks like, you know? So yeah, try not to just hold even like music in my career as like tightly and preciously as I once did, and kind of going, what does it mean just to, open up the windows and live a little, and, you know, not spend all my time stressing over this life, this musical life that I'm living, you
right.
know?
Right.
Because I love it so much. I just think about it all the time. It's like, you know. It's all I do. So,
and no one thinks about it more than you.
You know, so yeah, I mean, you know, it's, yeah. And so there's beauty in that. You grow a lot, you know, in the kind of time spent. You know, I was just talking to, actually had dinner, a little celebratory dinner with Shawnee, who I did the record with, Shawnee Gandhi, last night with our husbands. And And I was said something about like, yeah, you know, it's funny. I think like in my 30s, I am getting better at like not stressing about it so much, not being, you know, I say this and then tomorrow morning, I'll probably be the person up at 4 a.m. stressing over whatever I didn't get done the day before. But also just kind of, you know, being like things are going to work out the way they're meant to. And we can hope and dream and give it our best and all those things. But, you know, being all stressed out about it all the time is like half the time, I think the thing that holds us back, you know, got to just live our lives and enjoy whatever becomes of it. Live in the moment because you can rob yourself so much of the joy of all the beauty and good things in front of you by stressing over, you know, what you didn't get crossed off the to-do list, you know, yesterday or whatever. So I do think I'm getting better at that as I get older of just kind of, you know, maybe talk to my husband. I think I'm getting more chill about it. We'll see.
We'll keep us posted.
Yeah.
All right. I got one more question and then a very short lightning round, but I was wondering, I think we have very similar rings. Can we take a ring break and take a look?
Ooh. Look, that is beautiful. That. Oh, it is very right. similar.
Wow, that's nice. Really pretty.
Okay. I mean, yours is gold though, right? So mine's
Is yours silver?
Yeah.
Similar. If you punch someone in the face, they would have a similar mark.
Exactly. That's beautiful.
Okay. I know it was a few months ago, but I was combing through your photos at the CMA Awards. Everyone looked so good. You made it on the fashion pages, red carpet fabulous. What's your feeling of like that red carpet experience? Not that it's like an everyday occurrence for you, but, you know, the gowns, the hair, the makeup, the cameras, lots and lots of eyeballs on you, which, I mean, it happens in your shows, but like you're not going to have the mandolin on the red carpet. So what's it like for you?
Yeah, it's such a novelty, you know, kind of those sort of things. And I think because it's not something you get to do every day, there's like, I personally find it to be really fun. I think it's fun to go pick out some crazy dress you're only going to wear one time and you know you're going to, you know, get to lean into the fashion side a little bit more. You know, of course, that's not the thing you're going to wear grocery shopping. So why not just go all out and have a good time, you know? I got cracked up because somebody posted on like my Facebook that about the album cover, you know, not her style. And I was like, not her style. Like, you know, of course it's a dude, but it's like, why, you know, what's...
I'm shocked.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just like, first off, social media, it's a funny place if you spend too much time on there, which I've, you know, try not to do, especially around the time of putting a lot of content and music and things out in the world, because I don't think it's too healthy to do that. But it's like, well, what is, you know, someone's style? It's like a style can be on a given day how you feel. That's the beauty of it. It's kind of the way I feel about music. You know what I mean? It's like on a given day, I may be feeling like extra folky and bluegrassy and only want to sit around and sing old hymns or play Wildwood Flower. And then some days you might want to, you know, be learning some crazy Bach piece on the mandolin or whatever, you know, and fashion is kind of like that too. So I think like those moments where you can sort of step outside your normal kind of thing and do something else for a minute is fun. I love it. I think it's a good time.
I like that. All right, Sierra, let's do this lightning round and then I'll let you get on with your life.
Let's do it.
Lightning round. Who is the hardest working person in bluegrass?
I'm going to say Bela Fleck, even though I know he follows in a lot of the different areas, but that's a hardworking dude right there. And I admire his gusto. He's always doing something.
I asked Jerry Douglas that question and he did not even hesitate. He said, Jerry Douglas.
Yeah, I almost said myself. I was like, that's not fair.
What's your go-to soundcheck song?
Lately it's been Boom.
Yeah. Awesome. What's the best pair of gloves to wear while playing mandolin, like if you're playing outside?
Fingerless.
All right. What is the best part of your morning routine?
Oh, making my coffee for sure. I'm super into it. I've been working on my latte art. I'm getting there slowly but surely.
Oh, cute.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
What is your least favorite household chore?
Dishes.
Hand wash?
Yeah. Yeah. You got to hand wash the, you know, the pots.
I hate it. I would rather die. Stuff, but no thanks.
Yeah. I mean, I do it, but, you know.
All right. This is the last one. Where's the most beautiful place you've ever seen?
That's a tricky one. You know, the first place that comes to mind, because I was literally just talking about it, is like being out in Glacier, somewhere like that. You know, I was just out in Jackson Hole and I was talking to somebody else about it because it's gorgeous out there. And I was telling one of my brother's friends that that was one of the first places that I got to go like that when I was, you know, as a teenager, that I was like, whoa, like breathtaking, you know, to see that spot and do the whole drive. And went back a couple years later and was like, yep, it still holds up. I wondered if I would still feel that way after having seen so many places in the world. You know, you wonder if you're seeing it through older eyes and is it going to be as like breathtaking? And I was like, nope, still gorgeous out there.
Oh, cool. Amazing. Sierra Hull, thank you for joining me today and congrats on the new record. It was really
thank
nice
you so
talking
much.
To you.
You too. Thanks for having me. And always enjoy listening to the podcast as well. So it means a lot to be on here.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, of course.
Basic Folks 300th episode was produced by Ant the Man, Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is an official production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check out FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Search for Basic Folk on SiriusXM's mobile app. Check out our website, BasicFolk.com. Or you can find us wherever you listen to your shows.
Send this episode of Basic Folk to somebody who works too hard. Somebody that's always at the office, always going above and beyond, doesn't take enough time for themselves, and needs some cool, inspiring music in their life.
My wife?
Your wife.
Send this episode to my wife. Okay, we'll talk to you next time. We love you. Happy 300 episodes, Lizzie.
Happy 300 episodes, Cindy.
Bye.
Bye.